Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending 5th of November 1922, a real fascist comes to power, a British Prime Minister talks about balancing the budget, an economist talks about balancing the budget, some women stay to hear the gory details, a man dies, some books are sold, and communists manage to lose their own rigged election. Last week I started with Italy, promising that one day it would become apparent why I had done so. Today is that day. This is from Monday the 30th of October 1922. The King of Italy has invited Signor Mussolini to form a cabinet. Such is the amazing result of the movement we described on Saturday. There must be other results. Results, it may be, of far-reaching import for Italy and for the world. But some time must pass before their character can be foretold with confidence. There are very wholesome and very evil elements in fascismo. It has still to be seen which will triumph. The revolution, for it plainly is a revolution, has been surprisingly rapid and surprisingly bloodless. Everything has proceeded according to plan. Fascismo has become the state, as Signor Mussolini declared at Naples that it must and would become the state. It has entered the government, and it has certainly not entered by the area gate. I'm not quite sure what is meant by this phrase, back door, I guess. Mussolini delivered his harangue on Tuesday. The first rumours of active fascisti operations reached Milan late on Friday night. By Sunday we learn that their leader has been requested to take office. Everything fell flat before them. They mobilised their armed forces all over north and central Italy and quietly took over control from the prefects and other local authorities. They occupied post and telegraph offices, railway stations and other public buildings, set up a control over the press, and dispatched large bodies who effected a rapid concentration on Rome. The Factor government, Factor was the Italian Prime Minister at the time, proclaimed a state of siege that day, and perhaps may have contemplated an attempt to quell the insurrection. But a few hours afterwards they withdrew the proclamation. The king had refused to sign the decree. That was the end. The capitulation of the legal to the extra-legal forces was complete. The king, Vittorio Emmanuel III, I think, usually gets condemned for his actions or inactions here, and I presume it is one of the reasons Italy got rid of its monarchy. But if the Times is to be believed, resisting the fascists would have led to a bloodbath at best, and given the uncertain loyalty of the armed forces, there was no guarantee it would have been successful. I should think George V is thanking his lucky stars that nothing like that is likely to be confronting him any time soon. The British general election campaign is in full swing. On Friday the 3rd of November, the Prime Minister, Andrew Bonar, made a big speech. A lot of what he had to say is what we would nowadays call knockabout stuff, and I don't propose to quote it because there are few things as tedious as explaining a joke. He had very little to say about policy. About the only thing he did say is this. Let me say a word now about what I regard as really the most important part in the general scheme I have in mind of getting trade improved by increased confidence, by the sense that we are free from sudden alarms and excursions. The important thing is to cut down expenditure. Without that, there can be no reduction of taxation. My friend, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, this is a chap called Stanley Baldwin, who has many points of great strength, you will find him adequate to his task, has the same weakness that I have, of saying what he thinks at any given time. In his speech he indicated that, so far as he could judge by the explanation he has made, it will be difficult to do more than balance the budget. I think he is right to say that. It is easy to make promises. Every opposition, nearly all through my experience, has been lavish with them. Off the top of my head, the last time a budget, or a British budget, was balanced was in about 2000, and before that, 1988. Andrew Bonar is not the only one vexed about budget deficits. In two articles spread over Monday and Tuesday, a writer only referred to as a correspondent has this to say. With the commencement of hostilities in 1914, the world probably unwittingly entered upon the greatest financial gamble in history. It started with the printing by embarrassed governments of paper money. It was done somewhat cautiously at the commencement, but a gamble, however small, once begun, invariably gathers momentum. On Tuesday he says this: "Undoubtedly an essential of sound finance is for all countries to balance their budgets, in other words, for revenue to exceed expenditure. Britain has accomplished this exceedingly rare task in post-war finance, but the burden placed on the people in taxes is more than they are able to bear. People are groaning under the oppressive weight." He goes on: "It is impossible to get back to the old gold standard par value, because the world is so many millions poorer through the destruction of wealth, caused by the war and replaced by fictitious paper money. The world can get rid of much of the paper money by devaluation. In other words, the percentage of notes to gold must be higher, for no other reason than to account for the surplus paper money remaining after devaluation has taken place. I hope you're reading this, Mr. Churchill." There is something about this I don't entirely understand. Before the war, an ounce of gold was about £4 or 80 shillings. But the current price in 1922 is 93 shillings an ounce. It's a devaluation for sure, but it's not that great a devaluation. It may have something to do with high interest rates. I don't know what the interest rate is in 1922, but maybe that's the reason, or maybe it's much higher than elsewhere in the world. I don't know, but it's a curiosity. Bona Law's speech, which I referred to earlier, was given in front of an almost exclusively female audience. This is not entirely surprisingly, given that women can now vote. Women are starting to appear in other settings, which creates the dilemma. Should they be treated the same as men, or differently? This is from Saturday the 4th of November. "In an action for alleged slander, which came before Mr. Justice McCarty and a common jury in the King's Bench Division yesterday..." Sorry, I don't know what a common jury is, and I don't know what the King's Bench Division is. Actually, maybe a common jury is probably what we call a jury. It's probably to differentiate itself between that and a grand jury, which still exists. But no, sorry, a grand jury should be a petty jury, shouldn't it? Oh, I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll go on. "The question arose whether women jurors should sit to hear details of an unsavoury character. There were three women on the jury. Mr. Justice McCarty said that it raised a question of principle whether women were to be jurors only when a case was pleasant. As I understand it, women on a jury is a new thing, and it is a consequence of some women gaining the vote in 1918. It goes on. "Addressing the three ladies of the jury, his lordship said, the question at issue in this case involves relations between two men. It will involve sexual points of the gravest indelicacy, questions which even men would hesitate to discuss amongst themselves. If the ladies of the jury or any one of them desires to remain in that body, so be it. But if the ladies prefer that their places be taken by men, I will assent to their request." A little reminder that in those days, homosexual acts between men were illegal. Having said that, it is remarkable how rarely gross indecency cases, as they were known then, made it into the papers, perhaps because they rarely made it into court. Who knows? I don't. It goes on. "One woman at once left the jury box, but the other two remained. And his lordship remarked, I have a very high respect of the courage of these two ladies. His lordship then showed the two women the portions of the pleadings that he had marked in pencil, and then one of them remarked, we think that if we are called at all, we ought to sit whatever the case is." Monday the 30th of October brought some sad news. Mr. Edwin A. Pratt, who died suddenly at Esher on Friday, aged 68, was for 10 years a member of the editorial staff of the Times, his appointment being the first to be made by the late Mr. Moberly Bell. In that capacity, he showed the same patient industry which is conspicuous in his numerous published works. Of all these, the most important were The Rise of Rail Power in War and Conquest, 1833 to 1914, published in 1916, and British Railways in the Great War, which appeared at the end of last year. He was a strong opponent of socialism. Indeed he was. One of his books, one that the Times chooses not to mention, and one that I happen to possess, was The Case Against Railway Nationalisation, which is a fierce rebuttal of the arguments being put forward in favour of state-owned railways before the First World War. Talking of old books, this is also from Monday. Rare books and tracts, mostly of the 16th and 17th centuries, and including important Americana, the property of Lord Essex and removed from Cassiobury Park, Watford, will be sold by Messrs. Hodgson, 115 Chancery Lane, on November the 30th. Okay, maybe this isn't the biggest story in the world, even in 1922, but it is symptomatic of a huge social change. The aristocracy is in decline. The Industrial Revolution, death duties, and the 1910 Parliament Act have all served to reduce their influence. Death duties, in particular, were leading to the breaking up of the great estates, this being an example. They're still important, the pages of the Times is full of their doings, but the direction is clear enough. Cassiobury Park House would be demolished in 1927, or maybe it was 1928, can't remember. The people of Watford would gain a rather nice public park, and slightly lower house prices, owing to the building of a housing estate on part of the estate. Why the Earls of Essex would choose to have their estate in Hertfordshire is anyone's guess. Or maybe it isn't. The aristocracy may have been in decline, but they were still able to maintain their representation in Parliament until the late 1990s, pipping this lot by a few years. This is from Wednesday, the 1st of November. According to a message from Moscow, the state political department arrested in the Petrograd district all the independent candidates put forward by the workers for the elections to the Soviet 3 days before the election. The arrested workers number 35, and are accused of secretly belonging to anti-revolutionary parties. At Kolpino, it's a suburb of Petrograd, the factory workers boycotted the elections, and only communist representatives of the house committees and soldiers of the local garrison voted. A large number of the Petrograd workers refused to vote on account of the pressure of communist organisations, which threatened reprisals and the dismissal of those who would not vote for the candidates on the official communist list. The elections to the Soviet in the Don Basin have resulted in the defeat of the communists. 45% of the elected members are independents, 18% are socialists, and only 37% are communists. This result is due to the fact that in spite of the threats of the authorities, a much larger number of the voters registered their vote than in previous years. In certain districts where the number of communists returned did not exceed 10%, new elections have been ordered. Maybe the communists should dismiss the people and elect another. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.